Welcome to Comics Talk Comedy with your hosts, Jeffrey Bilodeau and Jesse Egan.
All right, it's another week of Comics Talk Comedy. We're back.
That's right. Jesse's good to be back.
Jesse's in studio. You were away the last couple of weeks.
I missed it.
Yeah, you were in D.C., right?
Yeah, went back east for the holidays, which was nice.
How was that? Good?
It was warm there. It was like it rained. It was warmer there than here.
Yeah, that's weird.
It was weird. Well, it's especially cold here. Like, I live at the beach, and my house has no insulation, so I'm freezing in that house. I wear all my clothes to bed.
You got what, 3-4 layers?
Yeah, and a jacket, too, and the hat.
That sounds bad. Is this the coldest winter you can remember?
They're always cold at my house, because I just have a little space heater, and if I turn it on too high, it pops the breakers in my shitty apartment, so I can only put it on medium, and it's still really cold.
Oh, that sucks.
But other than that, it was nice going home, saw the family, you know, not as much meltdown fights as usual, I think, maybe.
But you said there still was
there some. There was one. It wasn't involving me, though. I was on the outskirts of it.
Oh,
I was just sort of drawn into the middle of it.
Yeah.
It was really more between my...
And you didn't perform at all?
No, I did not perform. I generally don't perform when I go back home.
Okay.
I absorb what caused me to start comedy.
And then come back
and
with
I
it.
And I come back rearmed with that motivation of this is why I do this.
So you said you went up Wednesday for the first time in a long time, right?
Yeah, hadn't gone up in, I don't know, felt like a month, but I guess it was less, but it felt like a long time.
Yeah.
And I tried to riff stuff about the family and the holidays and the cold and all of that.
It was
stuff.
A random big crowd on a Wednesday.
Really was. And it's like, it's funny because when I talk to you about that, we're always like, yeah, I wanted to come up here and do my new stuff, and now there's this big crowd, and now I feel like I have to do my A crap, and we don't do that. All right, I'm like, I'm doing the new stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. For a group of that big, I don't think I did that. Well, I ended strong, but it was still like, they weren't easy for a group of 100.
It's so strange like that. Like last night we were at the Madhouse, and I felt like the first crowd that was, it was full, packed, wasn't maybe as hot as the second crowd that was just the pit. So
really?
You know, who knows?
Well, the pit is still a good amount of people.
That's true.
How was New Year's?
That was good. We had a really good lineup, really good show. Tamer, our guest today. Tamer's here, everybody.
Yes.
Hello.
he closed the show, of course, was awesome, and Brian Simpson was the host, which I hadn't seen him host, and he's a terrific host.
Is he?
And I thought the show was really twice as good because he hosted.
Okay.
Because his energy was terrific, his intros, he just kept it moving. No, he was really terrific.
Okay.
Yeah, and like only doing 5 minutes at the top, I'm like, man, they should have put you on.
Yeah.
You know, but then as it went, I thought, well, that was a good decision. He was a great host.
And it was another like showcase, like 10 comics.
Yeah, like 11, I think. But
okay.
He featured last night and he was great.
Yeah, I missed it, but I heard he was great. I had to go. I was too hungover.
Ah, yes. So you had fun on. I saw. Was Jono on the show or John?
No, he wasn't.
He was just randomly there.
He was randomly there. There was a bunch of people hanging out.
Oh, before we get too far, we lost a couple of people.
Unbelievable.
In the comedy San Diego scene.
Yeah, rest in peace, sacrilegious
Sac Dave. And then found out today with Jeff with the G, Armstrong.
Yeah.
Passed away.
And, you know, another comic texted me today. They said, two of the biggest characters I've ever come through Ocean Beach Comedy. And I said, yeah, Bob Hansen better watch his ass.
Yeah. He doesn't know who's next.
But I was just off the phone with Bob, and he was talking about, you know, Big Dan and Greg the Medic got to watch their ass.
So yeah.
He thinks those are, you know. But
those are out there.
I feel like Bob is an equally large character.
Sack Dave was expected, but Jeff with a G, I mean.
Yeah, because Sack Dave was sick. He had ALS, and he was in the hospital, and he had started deteriorating, and that was really sad, but he's also 81, 82 years old. But with Jeff with a G, he was 44, and he hadn't, I mean, we haven't seen him in a while. He hadn't been around, so... And nobody really knows what happened, but yeah,
sad. He came to our show when we co-headlined a few years, like last year or whatever. That was the last time I saw him.
Totally.
Burner.
He was always very supportive of us, you know. He was a sweetheart of a guy.
Yeah, so.
Burner?
Burner said he saw him at 7-Eleven like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, shocking. What did I do? I've been around the store, but they've been just having like special events for like New Year's, and then Vicky was there last week on Sunday. So I went up on Wednesday. And I felt I closed strong.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Some people talked to me after, and that's always nice, you know.
Yeah.
Some guy said that I had his favorite joke, so, you know.
There's something about the nuance of comedy that I really like. Like, you could do the same joke and just one part of it hits more or less than usual. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that in that setup, when you said my two favorite things, I like making love to the ladies and horse racing.
Oh, I always say that.
But it was something different.
It was a beat.
I can't put my finger on it. The beat was slightly longer or something because the audience reacted to that setup so hot that you knew right away that joke was going to just murder the whole way. And I don't know if there's a pause or beat, but it was almost like a misdirect, you know, like I like to like you think they're going to be similar.
Right.
I don't know, but yeah. I don't know. It's one thing I just really love to see.
Yeah, I was talking with somebody, I think it was Damien, about how because Argus was there, mm-hmm. and Argus wants a specific intro that's this long, like he writes for 170 uh-huh. magazines. Will Rogers calls him the Robin Williams of the baby boom generation. And I didn't want to go up because I didn't want to have to.
You didn't want to have to do that intro.
I didn't.
So did he read it off a page or what?
No. Vin did the first show. He nailed it. Kyle Ray did the second show. And he was like.
Butchered it.
He got it all there, but he was struggling.
Oh, that's a lot to remember.
Yeah. So reason I say that is because I might do the same jokes, but there's always something different that I say, and it's not like scripted like some comics you see. It's like bump it up, but over and over again. So
I think it's kind of good to test out like doing it with different beats and timing because you might find it work better a different way or a different word in there or something. I don't know. Yeah. But so yeah, and then last night I was at the Palace first, or yeah, no, that was it. New Year's Eve, I had the Palace.
Mm-hmm.
They had an early show at the Palace, 6:30 show.
Oh, you did that show too?
Yeah.
So three shows in a night.
No, I did two, just two, because there was only one at the Madhouse.
Really?
Yeah, on New Year's Eve. They just had the one late night show, 10 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
But the early show at the Palace was at 6:30 p.m. I mean, it was really early.
Did they do three shows?
They did two, but it was sold out. It was sold out, yeah. And the lineup there was really good too. I mean, it was Rel Battle, me, Eric Knowles, Eric Myers.
Okay.
It was pretty beast of a show. Like, I didn't want to leave, you know?
So you're the only comic with hair on the show.
Yeah, I was the only, only behaired comic.
That's a credit.
But that was because Bijan was stuck on the East Coast, so
yeah,
he called me last second on that one. But
well, that's cool.
So that was a fun New Year's Eve. Drank too much, though, and was really crippled yesterday, and then still feel crappy today.
Well.
So I got to pull through.
Yeah, and you got the Hole in the Wall show.
Yeah.
You got to let me know how that is.
I know. You told me that's the worst show that you've ever done.
Worst show I've ever did.
So I got that to look forward to, Tamara.
Yeah, did you let him know that? We'll ask him. Why don't we bring him in, our guest for the day?
Yeah, let's bring him in.
Hello.
Welcome, Tamara Catan, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So you were on the shows with Jesse at the Madhouse.
Yeah.
Did they work out well for you as well?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, he headlined. And
how long did you do?
I'm doing like 20s because it's like the 10 comic thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
Good night.
They give you 20s? I thought they were doing, either you get like 10 minutes like everybody.
No.
Oh, okay.
Brian said, I'm going to keep the show moving quick, and we'll give you as much time as we can. We just want to make sure we have enough time for the countdown.
Okay, excellent.
And so I ended up doing...
And then what about last night? Time.
Last night I did 20.
Oh, okay.
So were you on stage when the ball dropped? You did the...
No. I got off like right before so that we had time to pass out champagne and do do the thing together.
Yeah, that was weird at the store. Steve Trevino was the headliner, and he did like an hour and then did the countdown.
He did it himself?
Yeah, he was on stage. That's what they do every year at the store, that they just kind of break into the show. And then he did another 20 minutes after the ball dropped.
Wow.
Which I thought was tough because he was like telling people that they should leave, but most people stayed until the end.
Why did he tell them they should leave?
Well, or could leave.
Oh, could leave. Okay.
Yeah, but then anytime anyone would get up, he'd be like, oh, I'm almost done. So he would still guilt them for leaving.
You.
So how'd they do it at the Madhouse?
It was great.
Yeah, the show was over, though.
Show was over, but we all hung out. A lot of people hung out and stayed and had drinks. It was good.
Champagne toast, and then they brought all the comics up on stage together to sort of toast it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
My memory's not that good. But that's what happened.
Yeah. So you live in L.A.?
I live in L.A. and on the road now. Okay. I'm on the road so much now that it's like I feel weird saying I live in L.A. when I'm in hotels almost more than my own place.
Oh, really?
And is that mostly due to this last thing, the World Series of Comedy that you won?
I'd say two-thirds of it is World Series of Comedy, and then others is from hustling.
Yeah.
You know.
And so are you doing feature work, or are you headlining, or both?
Both.
So some club, I'm assuming that a lot of the headlining stuff is stuff you got through grinding, right? And then featuring is
yes
from...
Yes and no. Feature, you're supposed to win a year of feature work when you win the World Series of Comedy, but like Looney's I did last weekend, and I headlined all weekend, and they just had to be a World Series of Comedy weekend, and they had me headline an Ebo Brewer feature.
Oh, wow.
And then there's been a few clubs, like Looney Bin is going to have me headline too. And then a couple other spots, too.
How did you like Looney's Colorado Springs, right?
Colorado Springs, like 5 miles away from the abortion clinic that got shot out.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know that we, Zoltan and I, had met two women that worked there.
Yeah,
that.
Wow.
Yeah, after our show, then that happened. We were worried about them. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so Colorado Springs, that club, Looney's, I don't know how you felt about it. I thought it was such a terrific club, and I loved the light that they had.
Yeah.
The clock.
Yeah, you could see the clock. Yeah.
Have you seen that anywhere else in your travels?
Yeah. In Sarasota, Florida, McCurdy's. McCurdy's is even, that club is like amazing. It's like LED lighting, so there's no heat, but you have like an amazing spotlight. The lighting's great. The sound is great. The sound is amazing.
McCurdy's?
McCurdy's.
And where is that?
Sarasota, Florida.
Huh.
Really,
and they put a
club.
Big digital clock similar to that one?
Yeah, where the comics can
see
it.
So the comics
the
can see it, and at Looney's, the crowd can see it, or the host can see it, whoever can see it.
Yeah,
so it's like,
exactly.
But it's not obtrusive.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a terrific thing. It was like you didn't get any light signal to warn you.
Right.
You just already see how much time you got.
It's funny, because like the only club that really has it, well, ACC has a nice light.
Uh-huh.
Store is just a flashlight. I mean, the light bulb.
The red
and
light.
And then the Madhouse and Palace is just like a flashlight of your phone, right?
Madhouse is a red light, too.
Oh, they do. They
yeah,
do. Well, we'll be back. Coming back. You're listening to WSRadio.com, the worldwide internet talk. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Bye.
Welcome to Comics Talk Comedy with your hosts, Jeffrey Bilodeau and Jesse Egan.
All right, we are back, second segment. So how long have you been doing comedy now?
It'll be 5 years in March.
Oh, so
pretty great for 5 years.
Yeah, thanks,
you
man.
Know.
But I had like sort of an accelerated second and third year. I moved to London for a year and a half. And so I went from doing 8 minutes a night in L.A. to an hour a night in London.
The scene's good there?
It's super strong. And then there's just a lot less comics and a lot of venues. And there's a theater culture there, so like there's no drinks during a set.
Okay.
There's no even waitresses during a set.
You're kidding.
You have three comics, and then you have an intermission, and everybody goes and gets more drinks and goes out and smokes, and then they come back in, and then there's three more comics, and then there's the show. And that's the way that it is. But you get both extremes in the UK. You get theater-style shows that are really, really respectful and amazing audiences, and they want crowd work, and they want... And they're really patient with, like, premises and jokes and stories. But and then you have other venues that are like...
The Russell Hicks venues? That kind of thing? The straight crowd work, yelling...
No, I wouldn't call... I wouldn't call Russell Hicks a brand of comedy. I'm sorry. I don't even know that.
I know. I just meant it like those are what he seeks out when he's there.
He doesn't go there.
Oh, no.
Because what I'm talking about is, like, well, in the UK, there's, like... Hen-dos and stag-dos, like bachelorette and bachelor parties, are super out of control crazy.
Mm.
So there's like the theater clubs that are like no stag-dos, no hen-dos, not allowed. And those are the clubs that Russell's at, those clubs. The wild clubs in the UK are out of control wild.
Really?
Out of control, because they're only the stag-dos and the hen-dos. And the Brits can drink like an insane amount. Like,
got you. So
I've been at shows where riots broke out, like throwing chairs.
So he's
and,
still in the middle grade somewhere of not, he hasn't quite gone to that crazy.
I don't know I don't know that he would want that.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they're drunk in the UK is a very different thing than drunk in America.
Yeah?
Very different. Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
They just drink a hell of a lot more. People in the UK that are just like regular people, if they came and drank with a group of people in Los Angeles, they'd be like, oh, those guys have a drinking problem. And they're like, no, I'm just a man. And it's a Wednesday, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even the bars there, there's no, like, you leave the bars in L.A., and, like, you go to a bar in L.A., and you see that there's, like, it's almost like the tree line on a mountain. Like, okay, there's no more trees that grow above that line. It's like 40. And then you don't see a lot of 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds drinking in bars in L.A. But you go to London, they're filled with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're filled with them. Drinking is just a part of the culture.
Yeah.
It's a big part of the, and it's a huge part of the socializing. Like, in L.A., all the clubs and the drinking environments are all about women, and guys kind of have to, like, it's ladies' night out, and we have to be, it's like women are the leaders of the nightclubs. But in the U.K., it's the other way around.
Mm.
It's such a boys' culture that girls get into sports just to meet guys. Girls go to pubs to meet guys.
Huh.
I mean, of course, you get to the nightclubby clubs and it's different. It's yeah. women again. But like the UK is like really brotherly in huh. the in the drinking.
So you started in LA?
I started in LA, and then I did the Edinburgh Festival, and I won an artist residency. So I got to live in London for pretty cheap.
Okay.
And then after the artist residency, I decided to stay longer because I was making enough money. And I the first time I toured was all around Europe, really. And then I did the Edinburgh Festival the second time, and I did that for a whole month. And that's crazy. 134 shows in 1 month.
Wow.
6 to 8 shows a day. It's
wow.
crazy. Because the show started like 11 in the afternoon, and the last time I got on stage was at 3 a.m.
Wow.
So it was like, it was insane. And you do 14 days, one day off, and then another 14 days. And it was like, that was insane.
Wow.
It was insane. It's like 6 months worth of gigs
yeah.
in 1 month.
Man, yeah. talk about accelerated progress.
Yeah, I guess so.
So it's been 5 years, but it's been I've been working a lot.
You, where did you start? Years. Like, what was the first show or mic you did? Do you remember what?
Yeah, I remember it well. It was a place called, what was it called? Swanky Comedy in downtown L.A. And it was like, it was a buddy of mine ran this, two friends of mine actually ran this comedy night in downtown L.A. in a really nice place. And Patrick Granfar is the guy who was running the night with Liliana Velasquez, and they put me on the show. He goes, I know you're a great comic. And I go, dude, I'm new, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, no, but I've known you for a long time. You make me piss myself laughing and all this stuff. And it was sort of like new guy stuff. And then they put me on the show, and everybody on the show is really strong.
Yeah.
And then he goes, hey, I'm going to just put you on at the end. Is that cool? And I'm
oh,
like,
man.
What? And he's like, oh, and I don't mean to add any pressure, but there's a writer here from the LA Times.
Great.
So just kind of do your best five.
And you had never gone up before?
And I go, dude, all I have is five. Like, right. I don't have a best five. I just have five. So I went up and just ate a dick.
Really?
Just gobbled. Who's that Japanese guy that eats hot dogs? Just
it's competitive
just
eater.
Like a waterfall of dicks.
Oh, man.
Just competitive hot dog eating.
Gosh. So you went to the show just to support the show? Or?
No. Oh. He thought I was ready. He's like, you're ready.
He'd never seen you do any sets at all.
He'd never seen me do sets, but he'd seen me in a writing class, and he knew me as a human being.
Okay.
And there've been, I've had like street moments. Like I learned comedy from the street because
mm-hmm.
I used to live in a really bad neighborhood. And in our neighborhood, you know, the Dirty Dozens, you guys know that phrase?
Yeah. Mm.
The Dirty Dozens, you know, it comes from slavery.
Mm,
like when you play the dozens, mm-hmm. or like what battle rapping is now, the mm-hmm. street name for battle rapping is playing the dozens, and the dozens comes from slavery. They used to sell one slave at a time unless there was something wrong with the slave. Then they'd sell them by a dozen in a cage. And there'd be these guys that were like hair lips or deaf or had weird ears or messed up hands. And they'd all make fun of each other in the cage.
Wow.
That's where like your mama jokes came from.
Uh-huh.
So it's totally like comedy from pain.
Wow. Mm.
So the neighborhood I grew up in, like that was part of the culture. Like we'd have this thing called nutrition before lunch. It was a 10-minute break where the government gave you free milk and trail mix.
Mm-hmm.
And during that 10-minute break, we'd play the dozens. And so it was like, so he knew me from this stuff. Like we'd be at bars, like in a kind of a bad part of LA. And then we just start having sort of like an old French style battle of wits.
I got you. Were you friends with him from being a
yeah.
kid?
No, from a writing class.
Okay. What part of LA, what was the neighborhood that you grew up in?
Well, when we first moved from Egypt, we lived in Boyle Heights. And this is Boyle Heights in the late 70s. So it was like cholos. Gangbangers, like we'd hear gunfire at night all the time.
Jokes about that too. That
yeah.
growing up and being the only basically non-Latino in your class.
Well, here's the thing. Like I remember it well because like from eight years old, I come into the school and it was just like joining a prison.
Mm.
Like welcome to prison, and then I walk out into the yard, and then it's like, okay, what gang? And I see these little gangs of kids, right?
And how old is this?
I was like 8.
Okay.
So there's like this, all the black kids were over there, all the Mexican kids were over there, and then there were a few Asian kids over here.
So no white people at all.
No white people, but the scariest looking Asians you've ever seen in your life. You know what I mean? Like these are like, some of them were like, I'm going to be a Mexican. And I'm mm-hmm. like, you're Korean. Why do you sound like
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
You know? And then I saw a Korean kid with an afro. I don't even know how that happens, but he did. He had really curly. It was the weirdest
uh-huh.
thing. And so I couldn't pick. I was like a man walking onto a prison yard with no gang. because they were like, what is this kid? Like, I had an afro, but I wasn't black.
Yeah.
And then I was brown, but I was from Africa. So, like, the Mexicans were like, well, he's got pyramids. We got pyramids. And the black kids were like, he's from Africa. We're from Africa. But then they each, like, they just kept their distance for a while.
Yeah.
But so
where did you end up gravitating? Did you have to float?
The Mexican kids.
Yeah.
A little bit of both. Before I got into sports, it was the Mexican kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got along and for the most part. But then the biggest trouble I got into was with the Mexican kids. And then when I started playing sports and I got into basketball, then I became friends with the black kids.
Uh-huh.
And then it was cool. Once we got to, like, we moved out of that neighborhood and we moved to a better neighborhood, then there's a weird thing about Facebook that a lot of people that are immigrants probably have to experience that most people don't. When you're an immigrant, you go up the social ladder so dramatically.
Mm.
Normally, even going up one rung on a social ladder is impressive enough in America. Like, mm-hmm. you don't get to do that in other countries. When you're born poor, you stay poor. But in America, you can do that. But when you're an immigrant, I mean, we came from living in East LA to going all the way up to where my parents have a beach house in Huntington Beach now. But, like, on the way up that ladder, like, there's just, like, these dramatic things that happen. So, like, I have friends that went to jail,
mm-hmm.
And I have a friend who's in jail now, and I have a friend who's a surgeon.
Yeah.
And Facebook puts them all together in one place. So there's been times on Facebook where I've written something, and then one of my, you know, like, friends that I hang out with now is like, oh, you're such an ass, that's funny, but you dick, or something like that, like, jokingly.
Uh-huh.
And then a cholo friend will be like, what the fuck? He's like, fuck that guy, dude. He's like, I'll kill that guy. And I'm like, no, dude, mellow out. It's cool. It's just Facebook.
That's
but it's
so
like
funny.
Two worlds collide on Facebook when you've gone up, when you've lived in two different...
What I thought was interesting was during the break, you told us your street name, your nickname as a kid was Joker.
Yeah.
And tell us the reason behind that.
Oh, so in Mexican, I hate to call it gang culture, but it is gang culture a little bit. Like, you give someone a nickname that's the opposite of what they are. Like, Flaco is skinny for, like, a fat guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to call me Joker because I never laughed. Because I always felt like I had to be scary so that I wanted to be scary because
uh-huh.
I knew laughing. For me, it felt like weakness, and it felt like I showed them that, oh, I was weak, or you shouldn't be afraid of me.
Right.
Because I was tired. I learned to fight by being beaten up.
They thump on you
all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got beat up, like, daily.
Yeah.
That's how I found comedy, is this one kid beat me up every single day for no reason. I asked him, why are you beating me up? And he just started laughing. And he goes, see you tomorrow, bitch.
Wow.
And I was like, fuck. And the level of frustration and anger. And then I didn't really get help at home because my dad was abusive, physically abusive, and an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I was this ball of rage.
Getting
just
beaten everywhere.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
So finally, this kid was so much bigger than me. I used to have dreams that I was fighting him underwater.
Oh wow.
Like that, he was such a good fighter, and I was so slow compared to him.
Uh-huh. And this was at school?
This is at school. Now, this is about 15.
Yeah.
Okay. And administration didn't...
administration.
Sorry, I grew up in Maine.
Beating him up, that was the principal.
No, man. Yeah, the school was bad. The school didn't... I mean, they had real problems with the school. Because what ended up happening after is that this kid, he came up to me and I ended up making fun of him. I go, he's going to beat me up every day. I made fun of him. And he goes, if you stop making fun of me, I'll stop beating you up.
And he did?
And he did, yeah.
Huh. Are you friends with him on Facebook?
No, because I started making fun of him again.
Oh, jeez. So he unfriended you?
The laughs were better than the beatings. I could take the beatings.
That's funny, man.
That's good.
This music makes it sound like an after-school special.
Yeah, it does.
We'll be back in 3 minutes. Listen to WSRadio.com. We'll love the internet talk. Bye.
Welcome to Comics Talk Comedy with your hosts, Jeffrey Bilodeau and Jesse Egan.
All right, we are back with Comics Talk Tragedy this week. Not much comedy going
that's
on.
That's right. Man, that's a crazy... You told us another crazy story in the break, too, of why you had to basically move from that bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
That it escalated even farther.
Yeah, well, that kid, he told me, if you stop making fun of me, I'll stop beating you up. I agreed, and it was the first time where I went, wow, there's some power behind this comedy stuff. But then I missed the laughs.
Yeah.
I missed the friends, so I said, fuck it, I'm going to keep making fun of this guy.
Wow.
And then eventually, you know, the best way to learn to fight is to get beat up. And so eventually got to a point where I beat him up. And then he stopped. And then he tried to jump me, but at this point I was on a basketball team and had black friends, and my black friends beat up him and his friends, and they were in a gang called 13th Street, but I didn't know what 13 meant at the time because there was no 13th Street in Hollywood, but it was associated with the 13th letter of the alphabet for the Mexican mafia, and I didn't know that that's a big boy gang. And so I'm walking to school, and these two or three grown men in their mid-30s, cholos, I remember one of them had a teardrop tattoo. It was the first time I'd ever seen a face tattoo. And the guy looks at me and he goes, "Where are you from?" And I was like, "What? Nowhere?" Because that's a gang question. And I was like, "Nowhere. I'm not from anywhere." And he goes, "Are you sure you're not from Egypt?" And then my stomach sank because I knew that they were there for me.
Yeah.
And then that was it. And all I remember is waking up in a hospital bed. And, like, they beat me with bike chains. Like, my whole body was, like, bruised, but especially, like, around my face.
Wow. How long did you have to stay in the hospital?
I was in, it was a week off of school. That happened on a Friday. And then I think I was in a new school that Wednesday, so less than a week, but it was in a new school that Wednesday. And I remember it was kind of cool to be at this new school that was nicer,
yeah.
And everybody seemed a lot nicer. And I was there with a black eye and a punk rock t-shirt. So kids were like, "Who's this kid with the black eye?"
He's hard, you know? Yeah.
But the trippy thing is my parents thought they were putting me in a better school, but here's the shift that happened. Evil is still evil. In Hollywood, it went from marijuana and violence. And then we moved to Arcadia, and it went to cocaine and parties.
Mm.
So the violence went down, but the drugs went up.
For you, you mean?
For everyone. We didn't have cocaine in Hollywood.
Mm.
You know, that's the good thing about bad neighborhoods is the drugs are usually pretty chill.
Yeah.
Like in high school, especially high school kids in bad neighborhoods aren't doing crack yet. But high school kids in good neighborhoods, they'll totally try coke.
Mm-hmm.
You know what
they
I mean?
They have the money to spend.
They have the money because coke has this level of attraction to it. It's luxurious.
Right.
You know, it's like a top shelf drug, whereas crack is like, nah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they get to see it too.
Mm-hmm.
Like kids in the hood get to see what crack does to you. So like even though the violence was there, the effect of drugs was really low on me.
I got you.
I didn't even really drink back then. But once I got to high school in the good neighborhood, oh man, the world of drugs. It was like a Russian immigrant walking into a Costco. I'm like, wah wah wee wah. So many choices.
So you got into that pretty
deep?
Yeah,
then drugs were awesome.
So what happened in your life that made it change and kind of have a more happy personality and pursue comedy and all that?
I think my dad dying.
Okay.
Like I had a really shitty relationship with my dad, but when he got cancer, he softened. And he became like, I'm not mad at, like, my dad was abused too, physically abused too.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphor in my head, because I'm not mad at him anymore, like, I understand the dynamics of abuse now. That there's a guy that abused my dad, and that guy was like a vampire. And he bit my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned my dad into a vampire. And then he tried not to, but he bit me.
Yeah.
And now I have to be like one of those vampires on Twilight.
Right.
You know, I'm going to go to therapy so I can have a girlfriend.
You're like a daywalker.
Yeah, and I could go in the sun sometimes if I just learn how to.
So you're obviously very conscious of that. And if you were a father, you would.
I think that's why I'm not a father. Like a lot of people.
Because you're worried about it?
Yeah, because I've been bitten, and so I'm scared. Like, there was a while where I was scared of having pets because I was afraid I might hurt them.
Have you ever had thoughts of hurting animals?
I had so much anger that I would have really dark thoughts.
So you're worried about that coming up?
Yeah, I've had dreams before where, like, I got really angry and, choked a dog. Like, stuff that scared me because when I got older, I'd read books about serial killers, and they were like, those people harm animals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you'd see me around, like, I am around animals the way like a single 50-year-old woman is around babies. Like, I'm like, oh, let me shoot a boo-boo. You know what I mean? Like, I love animals so much.
Yeah.
And it's this stupid fear. It's almost like a PTSD thing where I'm not that. And my therapist told me, he goes, you're not that.
Right.
You know, the fact that you're working on it, the fact that you're aware of it means that you'll never be that. You know, you're going to be fine. But it's, you know, it's almost like living in a haunted house. Because, like, you have a lot of times if people have been physically abused, you have this thing called intrusive thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, somebody at my job when I had a day job would be like, I disagree with you. And in my head, I hear my dad's voice going, I think you're stupid.
Mm.
And so I'd react as if they called me stupid. And they'd be like, look at this maniac. But I was reacting to something that they weren't saying
they
at all.
Were, yeah.
So it's like a haunted house. You know, stuff moves around.
This stuff comes out in therapy that you're able
therapy
to analyze.
Therapy and comedy, really.
And comedy,
yeah.
How did you pick a therapist? Did you have more than one, or how do you decide what's a good one for you?
Dude, I had to go through like six.
You did?
It's like speed dating, you know, in a way, like or dating, where you have to find one that's right for you.
And how did you know? Like, you could just tell.
He was smarter than me.
Ah.
he was smarter than me, and that was a big thing. And then, like, so it made me, he was so smart that it was, he was smarter than me, and also I felt like he was really attentive, mm-hmm. like he really paid attention. And so the other ones, I don't know if smarter than me is the right phrase, the other ones felt like, because they weren't paying attention, that I could outsmart them. Mm-hmm. That's how I meant it. He's paying so much attention, he was mm-hmm. so attentive that I felt like he was too alert for me to fool,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, like, I liked him because I felt like I couldn't lie or play games. And
did you think that there was some risk of you doing that, of manipulating the therapist or lying to them in some
oh,
way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why did you think that? Because you'd get something different out of it?
Well, I studied social psychology in university, and I know a little bit more about psychology than most people. And I think my own issues make me go, I want this person to like me,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I know what they're looking for sometimes.
You give them what they're looking for.
So I give them what they're looking for. Mm-hmm.
Rather than
yeah.
get what you need yeah. out of this situation.
So I'm basically paying somebody to be my buddy.
Yeah, I see.
Which is so stupid. You know, it's like the most counter.
How long have you had the current one that you like, the therapist?
Here's the great thing about this one, too. I had him for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and then he said, I don't think you need to come in.
Really?
Yeah. He goes, I don't think you need to come anymore. He's like, my door's always open for you.
And then what, you started making fun of him, and then he beat you?
No. Dude, there's actually I probably have two or three bits that I've written from being in his office. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you don't go to him anymore?
No.
Oh, wow.
I mean, from time to time, if things come up, like the holidays are hard sometimes, like, but
you're very positive. I mean, I was saying this before the show, like, that some people think I'm positive until they actually know me. But when I talked to Tamara the first time, it struck me as, this is an actual positive person. This is a real positive person who affects, I think, other people in a positive way too.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know,
so is comedy the only thing you do kind of as your therapy now, or is there some other things that you try to get out? That, I mean, the anger is always inside of you, I would think.
Sure.
It's kind of like I go to AA meetings, you're always an alcoholic. Like,
yeah.
If you're an angry person, you're always an angry person.
Yeah.
Is there something that you do that you can get it out now?
Yeah. Meditation.
Okay.
I do it twice a day. I do transcendental meditation twice a day. And it's like, the way I think of it is, it's almost like windshield wipers. You know, like, it doesn't solve anything, and it doesn't last a long time. It's nothing magical. It's nothing metaphysical. I don't like the psychobabble speak about it, but I like what it really does, which is like, the more shit that lands on my windshield, the harder it is to see out of my windshield, the more likely it is that I'm going to get frustrated and get angry.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation, like, cleans the windshield.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Will more dead bugs land on it? Absolutely. But it wipes off your windshield so you can keep seeing and keep driving and keep going. And so for me, when I meditate, the thing I like about transcendental meditation is it doesn't push away your bad thoughts. You actually think about those bad thoughts.
Hmm.
You can, if you think about it for too long, you can like gently move your mind away from that thought. But it's basically just, it's two times during the day where I'm putting myself ahead of my issues or ahead of things. I'm putting myself first. I'm taking care of myself. And it's like a nap almost, in the sense that it calms you down. It slows you down. And, you know, when you go slower, you can see things more accurately.
Mm.
And so it's really helped me a lot. Like, even if I'm going to meet someone that really bugs me,
mm-hmm.
I'll meditate in the car before I meet them.
And then
I'll be able to tolerate them more.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh,
that's clever.
Yeah.
Who are some people that you don't like?
So I've had relatives that I can't stand.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have this class that I'm in. A component of it is anger management, and they talk about being present.
Yeah,
and
that's huge.
I think it's
huge.
Similar they had us meditate a couple times in class, and one of those things they were saying that I thought was interesting was like, feel your feet touching the floor, and hear your breath, and concentrate on this exact moment in time right now.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking about the future, the past, it was like being completely present in the moment, and somehow that also sort of wipes away the...
Totally. That's why so many people like to go and watch the sunset on the beach, right? It's because when you're looking out there, you realize how small we are,
mm-hmm.
and then when you realize how small you are, you go... then your problems automatically become smaller too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's really silly when you think about like all the disasters in the world and all the crazy things going on. Like, we focus so much on stuff and we amplify those things like a magnifying glass when we just pull back a little bit, you know?
Right. So are you one of those people that feels like, Because some people are like, well, if you're a comic, you have to be miserable, or you can't be... How do you feel about that? I mean, is that an important component of comedy, is that you're unhappy?
I think that's a misdiagnosis. I think in order to be a great comic, you have to be honest. And I think when you're miserable, you have a tendency to do that more.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're happy, sometimes you want to stay happy, or the effect of happiness is almost like drunken. You know, like you're a little bit less honest with yourself sometimes, I think. But I think when you're miserable... You don't have a reason to hold back.
Do you feel miserable all the time, or are you avoid that now?
No, I don't avoid it. Mm-hmm. You know what it's funny that you say all the time. Let me break up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Did I feel miserable in the past versus do I feel miserable now?
Right.
I feel more miserable now than I did in the past.
Why?
Because in the past I medicated. Mm. I was always on drugs, so I never felt anything.
Right.
Now I feel everything, but I'm
happy about
it. But
you get some ups and downs.
Yeah, exactly. I'm less medicated.
Do you medicate now at all?
No.
You don't do any drugs or drink?
No, I smoke weed.
Okay.
That's it.
That's medicinal, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and meditate, and comedy.
Okay. Well, we got one more segment. Coming back. You're listening. WS Radio Dog.
Welcome to Comics Talk Comedy with your hosts, Jeffrey Bilodeau and Jesse Egan.
All right, we are back. Final segment. So a lot of comics' regrets about comedy is that they started too late. They wish they started younger. Do you have that, or do you feel like the life lessons that you lived and had helped your comedy?
When I'm alone, I think to myself, I wish I started younger. And then when someone asks me on a podcast, I usually lie and say that I'm glad I started when I was 40. I think there's advantages to starting when you're 40. I don't know why more people don't chase things when they hit 40. Because at 40, you've had a chance to go after your initial career. And if you're still single and you don't have a lot of things to risk, shit, even if you're not, what's wrong with taking risks? You know, I really feel like a new person. Like I'm I don't even recognize the guy that I was before I got into comedy. I don't even know if I'd hang out with that guy, let alone recognize, you know?
Yeah, because we had Jason Collins on, and he started pretty late, and he kind of accelerated pretty quickly as well.
Yeah,
and then Dean Del Rey, he started pretty late, and
he
kind of... So there is advantages and disadvantages.
Totally. I mean, a lot of times people say what they say in comedy, it takes 10 years to be a headliner.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, maybe it takes 10 years to be a person. Maybe it's that most comics start at 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if you start at 30 or if you start at 40... It might be a little accelerated because you know some things. If you're willing to be honest about it and if you're willing to just be yourself, that's what I think we really do. Like, I think there's this great Hunter S. Thompson quote. He said, I don't believe the truth is ever told between the hours of 9 and 5. And there's a real truth to that. Like, during 9 to 5, we can't really be our free selves. We can't be wolves. We have to be dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you do what you're told. There's an HR department in case you don't. There's things that you've paid for that you have to keep paying for, and that job gives you that, so you can't really be yourself. And you feel it, like when you go to a bar after work and somebody shows up and they got a tie on, you're like, take that off.
Yeah.
Like, this is after 5, and that's our job is after 5. We don't have an HR department. We don't have a Toby at our office. So it's like, I like that's what I like about comedy, is being able to like really be free and really speak your mind. And I think sometimes that happens with age, but I think sometimes that happens because of traumas. And I think sometimes that happens for whatever reason. Maybe you were raised a certain way, but a lot of that questioning all the stuff that you've been told to believe starts to happen in your 30s and your 40s. It's almost like the second coming of punk rock. Like, it happened in my teens, and then I felt silly about it, and I got into college and really wanted the job, so I conformed.
Mm.
And then when I hit my 30s and 40s and I said, I did everything you said, but the promise you told me was a lie, now I was like, okay, well, I'm punk rock again. And now I'm questioning my government again, and now I'm questioning authority again for the first time, and now I have a mohawk with a receding hairline.
Yeah.
You know?
When you talk about the HR department thing, what are your thoughts on the sort of PC complaints that you hear some comedians talking about, the direction that audiences are going in, if there's such a thing, or you know what I'm talking about.
I'll give you, this is exactly what I said out loud to myself as I was reading a post that a comic wrote complaining about political correctness. Here's the word. I went, pussy.
Yeah.
Pussy.
Uh-huh.
How dare you? Like, it's like a boxer complaining about a black eye or complaining about sore hands. Mm. That's your job, man. It's your job. Yeah, they're going to push back. Good. That's your job. Like, there's two, and I read this on a post. I wish I could remember the guy's name, but it was brilliant. And what he said was, political correctness is not the problem. Comics who are afraid of not being liked is the problem. Mm. People want to be on TV before they master being on stage. And that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Like, you shouldn't be excited to make a group of people laugh. You should be excited about getting better at your craft. You should be excited about a new idea or a new way of thinking about something or a new perspective or a new way that Trump looks like Hitler, whatever. Mm-hmm. Those are the things you should be excited about. And that's where great comedy comes from. It's like people are so focused on the business because of where we live in Southern California that they try to skip over the art.
Mm.
It's like somebody gets great at Photoshop but never learned to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still fake it and you can do pretty good, but when you're really tested, you'll fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I there's a great example, like in pop culture, like we've Daniel Tosh over here, and in the UK they had a guy named Dapper Laughs. Right? Very similar in the sense that they're both sort of like bro humor,
mm-hmm.
make fun of girls, little slightly on the edge of racist. Daniel Tosh is a seasoned comic. When Daniel Tosh got called a rapist, he shut it down because he's handled hecklers for years.
Yeah.
Dapper Laughs wasn't like that. He didn't have the experience that a Daniel Tosh has. And he ended up on England's version of 60 Minutes in a black turtleneck going, "I'm so sorry. That's not really me. It's a character." Like, it just humiliated himself and his career ended.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Hopefully he'll get back on the horse and keep going, because that's what comedy's about to me. I get more excited when someone gets knocked down and comes back up than I am about a comic that just kills the whole time.
Yeah, it seems like people are really excited to see Dave Chappelle sort of coming back.
Yeah.
And I think it's for that reason, too.
Me, too.
He took a knock, but he's still like a hero to us.
Exactly. Now. Like, a lot of people say America's favorite archetype is the underdog. I would disagree. I say it's the aggressive underdog.
Mm.
Underdog just gets sand kicked in his face. Mm-hmm. The aggressive underdog gets up and throws it in his face and then tries to look not terrified.
Spider-Man.
You know?
Spider-Man,
yes.
Is kind of the aggressive,
yeah,
underdog.
Do you know, mm-hmm. actually, Stan Lee, when they interviewed Stan Lee and they said, "Why are you creating Spider-Man? This is ridiculous. This is, teenagers are supposed to be sidekicks. They're not supposed to be heroes." And he goes, "No." He goes, "The problem with Superman is that how can you empathize with him?
Yeah.
Nothing hurts him. And that's why I want to create Spider-Man. I want someone who's bad with girls. I want someone who's has pimples on his face and who isn't good. I want the everyman.
Gets beat up at school.
Exactly.
The whole thing. Yeah.
Exactly. He wanted us to be able to see ourselves in him.
Yeah.
And it was super insightful of Stan Lee, but he changed everything with that. Changed storytelling.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming up towards the end. This is a standard couple of questions we always ask. What's the worst show you've done so far?
However you want to define that, of course.
Is this going to be a what's the worst show and then what's the best show?
Yeah. Correct.
Can I give you a weird answer?
Sure.
It was one show and it was both.
Really?
Okay. I was in Edinburgh, Scotland, and the war had just started. Not the war, but there was Gaza, the Israel-Gaza-Palestine conflict was really kicking up. Mm. This is 2014. And, you know, I have a Muslim dad and Jewish mom, and I talk about them in my comedy. So I felt like, so sometimes I would speak about it in my set.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up, I did my set and it worked one time in a regular standard comedy room. And it worked and I got a great response. And then I did this show called, not Late in Live, it's called Spank. And but it's like a 3 a.m. show in Edinburgh, Scotland on a Friday night, hard to get onto and really rough crowd. Eddie Pepitone had walked on stage and 5 minutes into his set said, "I can't stand you guys, fuck this," and walked off stage. Eddie Pepitone.
Wow.
So then they had me go up, and here's the premise of the show, is during the middle of the show, if you have a philanthropy that you want money to go to, you can get up on stage, a regular person in the audience, get up on stage, take all your clothes off, and be fully nude, and then they'll pass a pitcher around and collect money for your philanthropy and make a donation in your name. Inevitably, in England, all the nudity is dudes, so there's a lot of penises on stage.
Right.
So that happens to be the act that I have to follow.
Oh, man.
So a red-haired, nude kid with his shaking his penis around, and then they go, "Your next comedian, Tamer Katan."
Oh,
people were still standing up, like, from staring at this kid, and I'm like, oh, my God. They're what? They're drunk. There's a bachelor party of, like, 25 Scottish kids, and they're loud, and they're crazy, and it's insane. So I go up, and I start realizing you need to be a one-liner comic to get through this set.
Uh-huh.
So I did one line, and it worked, but I'm not a one-liner comic.
Uh-huh.
So I ran out of one-liner jokes, and then I started going, well, shit, how do I get them to calm down? So I went to, if I can't make the, if I don't have short enough jokes, maybe if I talk about something really serious, it'll get them to shut up. So I talked about Israel-Palestine.
Oh, man.
And I go, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, you've got a Muslim dad and a Jewish mom. What do you think of the conflict? And I said, I think they're both wrong. You know, and I said, they're both wrong. They're both idiots. It's like trying to solve an argument between two people that are addicted to cocaine, but these guys are addicted to violence, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So people applaud a little bit. And then this one guy yells out, yeah, fuck Israel.
Oh,
and I'm like, no, dude, that's not what I was saying. And Europe is the opposite of America. Europe is very pro-Palestine, yeah, and we're very pro-Israel. So this guy yells out, yeah, fuck Israel. And then this other guy yells out, fuck you, mate. And I'm like, guys, guys. And they start just throwing chairs
at
each other. And I leave the show. I'm super bummed. My set ends. I go outside and I'm thinking, this is the worst show I've ever done. My friend goes, let's go. And I'm like, no, I'm not leaving because I don't want to look like a pussy. I'm going to stand here.
You're going to get wrapped, cut off.
Yeah.
Myself.
And then at the end, there was a line of people waiting not to yell at me, but to take pictures with me.
Ah,
really?
So it was worth it.
Turn
yeah, because they liked that I spoke my mind.
All right. Thanks for coming in. Bye.